But Landover, you didn't know Landover was made in Solly Hall?
Yes.
And then
yeah.
Mr. Street informed you. It was quite amusing, because I'm originally from Canada and have chosen the Midlands as my home now.
I think we might give it to one of our callers some earlier on. We've run out of time. It's all gone so quickly. I'll see you tomorrow live from the Toy Party Conference in Birmingham. But stay tuned. Drive's next on 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Hello, yes, welcome to Drive on 5 Live, 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Claire McDonnell and Johnny Iansen. Here's your news headlines. It's reported Israel has said it's intending to start a limited ground invasion into Lebanon as soon as today. CBS News is quoting a US official just hours after Israel's defence minister, Yoav Gallant, met troops near the border. Downing Street says the government remains supportive of Israel, but it's continuing to call for restraint from both sides. The Shadow Foreign Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, has told 5 Live he thinks the government's striking the right balance.
It is clear that Israel has the right of self-defense. Hezbollah has been lobbing rockets and missiles across the border into northern Israel, and Israel is defending its people, tens of thousands of whom have had to move south. It's defending its people from those rocket attacks.
Hezbollah's deputy chief says they are ready to respond. The BBC has apologised to Amanda Abington and upheld some of her complaints against her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannicci, but cleared him of the most serious allegations. It's understood while complaints of verbal bullying and harassment were upheld, claims of physical aggression were not. He has always denied the allegations. Our media editor Katie Razzle has been looking into each of their reactions.
She has said, it's vindication of my complaint. I'm very happy about having an apology. It means a great deal to me. A spokesperson for him, for the Mail, was quite on the front foot, said, you know, he's relieved that the overwhelming majority of allegations, the BBC decided to uphold some allegations to avoid the accusations of a whitewash.
Disciplinary action is going to be taken against 4 Metropolitan Police officers and a member of staff over how they handled allegations against serial rapist David Carrick. The former officer was handed at least 30 years in jail in February last year. One of the Conservative leadership candidates, Tom Tugendhat, says he'll work to rebuild trust in the Tories following July's election defeat. He's made his pitch to replace Rishi Sunak at the Conservative conference in Birmingham and was followed by fellow contender Kemi Badenoch. The two other candidates, James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick, will get their chance to speak tomorrow. The UK's top civil servant, Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, has announced he'll stand down at the end of the year. He says it's on health grounds. And passengers on the Villa V Residences Odyssey cruise are finally due to set off from Belfast on a 3-year round-the-world trip, 4 months later than scheduled. The ship was supposed to depart in May, but was held up because it needed repairs. The passengers are excited at the chance to be able to get away.
Absolutely love Belfast, but we're happy to finally get on our trip.
We figured it would come sometime, but it is a little bit anticlimactic just because we thought we would go earlier. But we're thrilled. We're thrilled.
We are so excited. We've been here almost 4 months now, so we are ready to get on the ship.
That is your news. Your sport now comes from Delith Lloyd.
Thank you, Johnny. Hello. Manchester United are set to stick with manager Erik ten Hag for this week's matches, away at Porto in the Europa League and at Aston Villa on Sunday. The pressure is mounting on the Dutchman, though, after 3 defeats from 6 in the Premier League to leave them 12th in the table. Arsenal defender Jurrien Timber says he's in total agreement with Manchester City's Rodri that the current fixture congestion is dangerous, and has revealed that the increased number of matches is a big topic in the Arsenal dressing room. The Dutchman spent 9 months out last season with a knee injury. The Gunners face Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League tomorrow. And India have set records for the fastest team, 50, 100 and 200. On the fourth day of the rain-affected second test against Bangladesh in Kanpur, they needed just 3 overs to reach 50, 10.1 overs to reach a century, and got to 200 in 24.2 overs.
A look at your travel. The A1M in County Durham heading north. Bridge repairs continue there, so it's north of Junction 60 at Bradbury. One of the lanes is closed, looking heavy on the speed sensors. The M57 Merseyside and Junction 6 at Kirby, an accident's happened. One of the lanes is closed southbound. The M6, the breakdown has been moved off the road on the northbound side, 18 to 19, heading up to Knutsford. One of the lanes was closed there. The queues are starting to dissipate now. The M25 and clockwise queues still there across the top, so 22 to 23 at the A1M at South Mimms. And then
then you've got the queues after the earlier accident as well. They're on the clockwise side as well at Junction 25 Enfield, but again, they are easing. It's a broken queue now. Along the bottom, another accident's happened anti-clockwise at Junction 6 at Godstone. One lane is closed there and roadworks are causing delays, and there's lots of localised flooding, as you can expect. A section of Crosby Road South, that's flooded at the moment. That's the A565, and that's in Seaforth in Liverpool, so that's blocked. And then you've got a big section of the A577, that's Southgate, that's flooded as well, and that's blocked near Wigan. And the trains are not great either, so I would check on the branch lines. Merseyrail, for example, between Houghton and Chester, and between Houghton and Ellesmere Port, flooding. It means buses running instead. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
Orna, thank you very much indeed. It is indeed filthy out there. Very important travel updates on Drive this afternoon. Good afternoon, welcome. Johnny Ianson and Claire McDonald with you on Drive this afternoon. Hello, Johnny.
Hello. Hi. Pleasure to be here.
I didn't ask you, actually.
Well, I just I've preempted the question there like a good journalist.
Thanks for asking. I'm delighted to be here.
I know that you're that kind of woman that likes to know how everybody is.
I know, I do. And you got there. And also, you saved time. Saved extraneous questions. So we're with you for the next 3 hours. It's great to have your company. Important breaking news, as we were just hearing, that the BBC's American broadcast partner CBS is reporting that an official in Washington has confirmed that Israel has notified the US it intends to launch a limited ground incursion. We will speak to our man on the ground in Lebanon shortly on that one.
Also on the programme, I am holding in my hand right now a Microbit. This is a fantastic little bit of kit which tracks kids' fitness. Made even more excited by the fact that the kids themselves have coded it and done all kinds of magical jiggery-pokery stuff that me and Claire don't really understand.
No, we don't.
But thankfully, these kids do.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk more about that on the programme. Kids' activity levels and also at the same time learning to code, which is really important for the future of technology.
Just incredible, isn't it? And they're already doing this in playgrounds. It's kind of taking the fear away, so we're going to be talking about that. We've got some brilliant guests on the show for you this afternoon. We've got James Graham. Yes, that James Graham, the incredible playwright and the writer behind BBC One drama Sherwood. He's very unhappy that those cooling towers, which kind of are affiliated with coal mining, essentially, you know, and that's come to an end. But, you know, that's it. We move on to a new chapter. But he says these are important landmarks at Radcliffe-on-Soar, the two cooling towers there, that he thinks should be preserved. So I've been catching up with him. He's actually with Elton John on Broadway. We actually split off from a rehearsal with Elton John.
We've all been there.
To come and talk to 5 Live Drive. I don't think we have, Johnny. So we'll play that interview. And we've also got Rock Royalty coming in, haven't we, to the studio?
Yes, we're going to talk to a member of The Alarm. Punk fans. Or are they post-punk?
Kind of post-punk.
Post-punk, I think it is.
Punk rock. Mike Peters, lead singer.
Yeah, he's going to be on the show later. Not necessarily speaking about The Alarm, but how he's gone through this really groundbreaking treatment for cancer.
Yeah.
Which has made an incredible difference to his life. Cancer that came on really, really suddenly, but just as quickly as it's come on, thankfully is in remission because of this new groundbreaking treatment. So really looking forward to hearing from him later on the programme.
Part of a trial. I've been speaking to the professor who actually put him through that, which is quite incredible. You know, the man just effectively saved his life. I mean, he's in remission at the moment, so we're really happy to welcome Mike and his wife Julie into the studio later. All that on the way right here on Drive.
More diamonds than the Queen of England.
Welcome to the world of thieves and hoaxers and con women.
She does sound fabulous though. Massive dogs, lots of cars.
But who are these lady swindlers? And did they get away with their frauds and deceptions by using their feminine characteristics?
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She's a bit of a one-off, really.
Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley.
Where true crime meets history.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
So, as we were just saying, the BBC's American broadcast partner, CBS News, is reporting that an official in Washington has confirmed that Israel has notified the US it intends to launch a limited ground incursion into Lebanon. This official says the incursion could start as soon as today. Earlier, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, hinted that a ground invasion could be imminent. He told troops near the Lebanese border that the military would use forces from air, sea and land in its fight against the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group. His words are voiced by one of our producers.
For the return of the residents of the north to their homes, we will be ready to make every effort. This is your mission. This is the mission of the IDF, And this is what we will do, and we will employ all that is needed, your forces, other forces, from the air, from the sea, and also from the land.
Meanwhile, the deputy leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon, Naim Qassem, says it's ready for a potential cross-border ground offensive by Israel. In his first speech since the group's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed last week, he acknowledged that it was a big blow, but claimed all fallen leaders would soon be replaced and Hezbollah would continue its battle against Israel.
The Islamic resistance will continue to confront the Israeli enemy in solidarity with Gaza and Palestine, in defense of Lebanon and its people, and in response to the assassinations of leaders and the killing of civilians. We recognize that the battle may be long, and all options are available to us. Should the Israelis decide to launch a ground invasion, the resistance forces are ready to engage with it.
His comments come as the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Iranians that there's no place in the Middle East that Israel cannot reach as his military launched further strikes on Hezbollah in Lebanon. He made the comment in a video aimed specifically at the Iranian people.
I want to address you, the people of Iran. I want to do so directly, without filters, without middlemen. Every day, you see a regime that subjugates you make fiery speeches about defending Lebanon, defending Gaza. Yet every day, that regime plunges our region deeper into darkness and deeper into war. Every day, their puppets are eliminated. Ask Muhammad Deif. Ask Nasrallah. There is nowhere in the Middle East Israel cannot reach. There's nowhere we will not go to protect our people and protect our country. With every passing moment, the regime is bringing you, the noble Persian people, closer to the abyss. The vast majority of Iranians know their regime doesn't care a whit about them. If it did care, if it cared about you, it would stop wasting billions of dollars on futile wars across the Middle East. It would start improving your lives.
Well, let's talk now to our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Bacega, who joins us live from Beirut. So, Hugo, a significant development in the last hour or so. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so there have been reports all day, really, that there have been some small teams of Israeli special forces mounting some small raids across the border from Israel. And now this, you know, information from that's been reported by CBS saying that the Israelis have notified the Biden administration that they intend to go ahead with this, what has been described as a limited ground invasion of Lebanon, and that this incursion could happen imminently. So I don't think there's any surprise here. All indications coming from Israel were towards, you know, the possibility of a ground operation in southern Lebanon. The Israelis have been saying that they want to allow the return of those 60,000 residents who have been displaced from communities in northern Israel. And military officials have been saying that the intention here is to create a so-called buffer zone in the south to destroy the infrastructure that has been built by Hezbollah in the south to push Hezbollah away from the border. So no surprise, but again, those reports emerging now that the Israelis have officially notified Washington that this is what they're planning to do.
We heard there from Benjamin Netanyahu, that TV appeal directly to the people of Iran. We've also heard from the deputy leader of Hezbollah, Naim Qassem, who is saying we are ready for the ground incursion. So are we to believe that, you know, whatever Israel do, they will be met with force?
Well, again, I think it wasn't really surprising that Naim Qassem was defiant in this speech. It was the first time that he spoke publicly after the killing on Friday by Israel of Hassan Nasrallah, the then powerful head of Hezbollah. He acknowledged that it was a blow, but he trying to project strength, saying that, you know, the group hasn't been weakened, even though we've seen that Hezbollah has been significantly degraded with, you know, almost 2 weeks of intense Israeli airstrikes, also the assassination of senior leaders. I mean, Hezbollah's leadership has been decimated by these airstrikes. So I think there is the big question here about the, you know, the capacity that Hezbollah has to organize a coordinated, significant response to any kind of Israeli invasion. Naim Qassem wanted, you know, everybody to believe, including the Israelis, that Hezbollah still has the capacity to fight an invasion. But I think this remains a big question mark here as a country waits to see what is going to happen.
I mean, there have been many in recent history. Of course, there were the 80s and 90s when Israel was at war with Lebanon. 2006, there was an eventual withdrawal. We can understand why Benjamin Netanyahu may want to do this for political reasons. Is there appetite within Israel itself, do you think, for yet another ground war?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting point because, you know, every time the Israelis have come to Lebanon, it hasn't been easy for them. It's been easy to invade, very difficult to get out of the country. And I think, you know, in Israel, there is more popular support for this operation against Hezbollah. I think what the Israelis have been saying is that no country in the world would accept being in the receiving end of rockets almost every day. And again, all the disruption that these attacks by Hezbollah have caused in communities in northern Israel. So I think there is, you know, public support for what's happening here in terms of these Israeli airstrikes. The Israelis have been extremely successful in weakening Hezbollah in a significant way, in killing, you know, top leaders, including Hassan Nasrallah, who for 30 years was the face of Hezbollah. So I think, you know, the Israelis are enjoying support, not only domestically. I think there is some kind of international support from Israeli allies, in particular in the West, who believe that Israel is acting in self-defense, in targeting Hezbollah, in trying to weaken Hezbollah with those airstrikes. So again, the Israelis seem this campaign so far extremely successful, and I'm sure that many in Israel right now, including military officials, are saying that this campaign needs to continue. The Israelis have no reason to ceasefire, to agree with any kind of deal at the moment, because again, they think that they've scored some very significant points.
Hugo, thank you so much for the update. Our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Bechega, with the update on that. Of course, if there's any developments whilst we are on air here on 5 Live Drive, we will bring them to you.
We will on the programme in, well, the next hour or so, talk about the BBC issuing an apology to the actress Amanda Abington and upholding some of the complaints of verbal bullying and harassment made against her in 2020, made against him, I should say. And this is Giovanni Panici against the during the 2023 Strictly programme. BBC News has been told that Giovanni has been cleared of the more serious claims of physical aggression. Our media and arts correspondent David Sillitoe will have more on this just after 5 o'clock.
Yeah, coming up before then, we're going to be speaking to the Alarm frontman, Mike Peters, who is on the brink of being completely cancer-free. Yeah, he has been living with a form of blood cancer for almost 30 years, but after success with a new clinical trial, he is preparing to undergo a new stem cell treatment which could rid him of cancer completely. Mike will be joining us around 5:45, and we'll also speak to his wife Jules and hear from his consultants at the Christie Hospital, because this is the interesting part. Professor Adrian Blore, who combined treatments to essentially put Mike into remission. Take a listen.
Standard treatment with chemotherapy we know doesn't work as well as we would want it to. So Mike was enrolled into a trial, that's why he came to the Christie, which is looking at a combination of standard chemotherapy with a drug called acalabrutinib, which is a targeted treatment. The aim of that to try and more specifically target the cancer cells, and looking at whether or not the combination of that with chemotherapy works better than the chemotherapy alone.
So that is on the way, but we have to play you this now. Family members of hostages in Gaza have given a press conference in London as they prepare to mark the first anniversary of the kidnap of their loved ones on October the 7th last year. Eilat Svatitsky spoke at the news conference.
My name is Ayelet Svetitsky. I'm the sister of Roy Popowal, a British citizen who was murdered just outside his house on October 7. My mom, Hannah Perry, was 79 at the time, and my brother, Nadav Popowal, who was 51, were taken hostage and held in the tunnels together for 49 days until my mom was released on November 24th. When she was released, she could tell us of how Nadav was doing. She described how little food she was given, and the conditions that were they were being held at. We kept praying and fighting for the release of Nadav and all the hostages. In May, Hamas released a video, I'm sure many of you saw it, with my brother saying who he was, with a big black eye. Hamas then claimed my brother was no longer alive. And on the 3rd of June, it has been confirmed by Israel that Nadav had died several months earlier.
Well, that press conference is continuing. That is Ayelet Svetitsky speaking just a few moments ago. And later in the programme, we're going to catch up with Steve Brisley again. He's come on Drive quite a lot. His brother-in-law, Eli Sharabi, was taken hostage in the Hamas attacks on the 7th of October. So he will join us. And he's been part of that delegation to government today and has been taking part in the press conference too. So Stephen will join us later here on Drive, 20 past four.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Let's turn our attention to the economy now. And since taking power in the summer, Labour politicians have been warning there are going to be lots of difficult decisions as they work to fill what they claim is a £22 billion financial black hole left by the previous government. There's just over a month to go until the most difficult of those difficult decisions that are likely to be announced in Rachel Reeves' first budget as Chancellor. Our business reporter, Peter Ruddick, has spent the day in Leeds to find out what people want to hear. Afternoon to you, Peter.
Afternoon, Johnny.
Firstly, beginning with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, just how difficult a position is she in right now, do you think?
Well, look, on the one hand, we know, we've spoken about it so much on this programme, the economy is not growing as much as anyone would hope. And in fact, actually, today, the people that put the stats together revised down their verdict on how things were doing sort of between April and June. At the same time, we know that government debt is at a pretty high level, right, because of the impact of the pandemic and the rising cost of our public services because of inflation and wage increases. And then all of that, plus, of course, the sort of this black hole you mentioned that the government claims is there, is why we are having this sort of message, if you like, that there are difficult decisions. It's really, really quite difficult. But it's really important to remember that black hole only matters if the government wants to keep to its own self-imposed rules about how it runs the economy. And the decisions that they say are difficult, of course, are not inevitable. They are choices. They're always choices. And there are other choices, you know, for example, borrowing a bit more, that exist too. And of course, we do think that probably the government will have been aware of the scale of the challenges when it went into the election. But at the same time, potentially, the Labour Party made it a bit harder for themselves because they constrained themselves by not raising some of the taxes they could do now. So it is difficult, but perhaps not as difficult as they would have us believe. And also, they probably constrained themselves a bit more than they needed to.
You've been out and about speaking to people today, Peter. What have they been telling you?
I have indeed, and you might be able to hear the rain around me. I'm just in Horsforth. I'm just outside a brewery here. It's been raining all day.
Is it rain or is it a beer tap in the background? I
can confirm. I don't think brewing day is today, actually. Okay. I promise you it is the rain.
Unlucky.
We've been in Leeds partly because, of course, Rachel Reeves represents a constituency here in Leeds, just not too far from where I am. I'll start by just playing you some of what her constituents had to tell us about how they're feeling ahead of this budget.
The Labour government now, I think it's disgusting. When they're taking £200 off us, pensioners, doctors want 22%, train drivers want 22%, We don't get 22%, do we? We're just going to fix income.
I do get a decent-ish wage, but I still can't manage on that wage, so I have to get help from Universal Credit for top-up. I have to get the single person's discount because I can't manage to look after my three kids on my own. I already get help with my shopping from family members and stuff because I can't afford to do that myself. I just don't think she's doing a very good job at the minute.
I mean, the government is talking about growth. And entrepreneurs, small businesses, I think, are the engines of that growth. So I would hope that they will see what we bring to the economy.
Obviously, we've been warned by the Chancellor that there's going to be a lot of pain for older people to feel in particular, I think. I'm hopeful that there'll be good done for working people, for people who've retired, like myself, and also for people who are harder.
Impossible to please everyone, of course, and that's just some of the views in Rachel Reeves' own constituency. She's going to have to please a lot of people when she delivers that budget in a month's time. Mark Costello's with me, Mark, the boss here at Horsforth Brew. Just before I go any further, that is the rain, isn't it? It's not, you're not pouring me the world's largest drink. talk to me about how things are at the moment, because I'm interested about, we've been talking about these difficult decisions. When the government are quite negative about what's going on in the economy, there are fears. In fact, some economists have said it in the last couple of days. Actually, you're making people quite scared. They don't want to then go up and spend in businesses like yours. Do things like that, those negative messages, do they have an impact on your day-to-day business?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, we've had bad news for a number of years now, and it's just a series of bad news stories that have a short-term impact on the business. But we've been having that for about 4 years, so they do have an impact, and people then start to believe it. But they do forget, it's just when the next bad news story comes out, it hurts.
We know difficult decisions are coming, though. Yep. I think there's no way around that. For you as a business, presumably you'd like those difficult decisions to be addressed elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's been a tough 4 years. Costs have just skyrocketed. So we're hopeful that we're not going to get burning with any more costs. That's what I'm really worried about. I think for me personally, I think the good news stories that have come out are the public sector pay rises. I think that's going to help put some cash back into the economy that people will spend. So hopefully we'll get some of that benefit when they start hitting.
A bit of spending power. I mean, the message is likely to be that those with the broadest shoulders sort of should bear responsibility for some of that pain. A lot of people listening will say, businesses are doing well. They're people got money at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how difficult things are, because you are really week to week, month to month.
Yeah. There's always going to be winners. But I'd say that we're probably not one of those at the moment. We only went full-time as a brewery in the first week of lockdown, so we've never had that opportunity to become one of those winning businesses. Obviously, there are people that are doing well, and I think, you know, if we ever get to that point where I'm earning six figures, great, tax me as much as you like. It'd be worth it.
We're obviously, because it is raining, we're just outside here in your tap room, and I can see your van you deliver to all over here.
Yep.
Fuel duty, though, that could be something that changes. Would that be a problem for you?
No, because I've got an electric van.
Ah-ha-ha! I didn't even spot that.
Yeah,
right, okay.
Yeah. We've had that 4 years, and that's been a godsend, to be fair.
Yeah.
Really, it's a nice drive, but we've not been hit by the fuel crisis.
And then just finally, obviously, on a personal level, you're a business owner, but you're living, breathing the economy like the rest of us. Is there anything in particular you want to see away from business in the budget in a month's time?
Yeah, personally, I want to see some support for youth. I think Gen Z get a hard rap from a lot of people, a lot of angles, but we need to be supporting them to make the best out of their lives and their careers and their education, because they get neglected. The youth always get neglected, and there's a lot of talk, obviously, about the winter fuel payments, but the youth need to be getting that opportunity to earn the money, so then when they're in the pensionable age, they don't need a winter fuel allowance because they've already made their money.
Mark, it's not brewing day today, right?
Nope, not brewing day today.
What's the next brew that's going on?
That will probably be tomorrow. It'll be our best-selling beer, Trinity. Tomorrow, yeah.
Okay, right. I've come on the wrong day, Johnny. I need to come back. Johnny Clare, worth saying, obviously all of the rumours and speculation are going to kind of continue for the next few weeks about what might be announced in the budget. What we do think is that I mentioned those self-imposed fiscal rules. There might well be a bit of a tweaking of those rules, and people listening might go, why on earth am I bothered about that? It's not going to impact me. Well, it will impact how much money the Chancellor might have to play with. So keep an eye on that, because I think we might get some announcements on that.
Great stuff, Peter. Thank you very much. That's Peter Ruddock there with Mark Costello, the owner at the brilliant Horsforth Brewery. I can vouch firsthand how good their beer is.
Oh,
by the way.
It's making me thirsty.
Single-handedly trying to keep the economy afloat in North Leeds. Just doing my
good
bit.
Good for you. Good for you. Now, to the contenders hoping to become the next Conservative leader have been speaking at the party's conference in Birmingham today. Four MPs are in the running to replace Rishi Sunak, Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch, who made their pitches today, and of course James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick. They're going to speak tomorrow. Let's hear a bit of what Tom Tugendhat has had to say at one fringe event where he made an apology over the Conservatives' election performance.
I was on doorsteps across England, and I have spoken to hundreds of people across the United Kingdom about how that election worked. And let's be honest, thousands of activists, hundreds of candidates put their absolute all into a campaign and were let down by others. It wasn't this party that failed. It wasn't the ideas that failed. It was the centre that failed. And we need to own that. And so from my perspective, let me just say to all of you, I'm sorry. The infighting in Westminster, the chaos in Westminster, and then the campaign, they all let you down. I'm sorry.
And Kemi Badenoch sought to clarify her recent comment suggesting maternity pay had gone too far.
I think maternity pay is quite important. And this was actually a long discussion we were having about the role of the state in deciding what businesses should do. But let's take a step back. Who remembers the phrase, there is no such thing as society? Yeah, everybody remembers. Mrs. Thatcher gave an interview to Woman's Own magazine where she was asked the question. She said there's no such thing as a society. She was talking about people wanting government hands up, that they're only individual people and families. And that very good explanation got cut down into a soundbite that was used to attack her. When you are a leader, when you are a Conservative, when you are making the argument for Conservative principles, your opponents are going to try and turn it into something else. We need to decide who's going to be leader of the party. Not the left, not the Guardian, not the BBC, just Conservatives.
Let's speak to our political correspondent, Hannah Miller, who's at the conference. Afternoon, Hannah.
Afternoon, Claire.
So we're hearing there the recovery job that Kemi Badenoch is doing on her comments over maternity pay when she was asked about it yesterday. Did she do enough, do you think? And what did she take the argument on to today?
Well, I think she has repeatedly now said over the last 24 hours or so that those comments were misinterpreted. There are certainly people in her team would wish that this row hadn't quite erupted in the way it had, but I think she has clarified what she was trying to say. What she did go on to talk about in the conference hall around the time of that clip that you just heard then, where she started to talk about a business in her own constituency which she said had closed because the owner had been struggling to pay maternity pay and had struggled to pay the minimum wage. They couldn't afford it, and she was using that as an argument to say that we need to look at the regulations that many businesses face. The natural question that then comes after that, I think, is to say, well, you know, she's not saying, clearly she's not saying that we should be getting rid of maternity pay, but is that something that should be on the table? Is minimum wage on the table? She wants to be having this argument about principles rather than policies, which is how she thinks the party can kind of rebuild and be ready for 2030 as she sees it. But what exactly is on the table when you're having that conversation about principles? She, as I say, she used the talking about the minimum wage as a kind of example. And I think what the difficulty for Kemi Badenoch with that is, and around all of this, if she is trying to talk about principles, she is trying to be quite frank in the comments that she's using. But a lot of this does then point to how well she would be able to communicate as leader of the opposition, whether these messages would become a bit confused in people's minds, even if, as yesterday, it is starting to sound like she really didn't mean to say that maternity pay should go, but that's how a lot of people took it. She kind of allowed herself to be misinterpreted, and I think for some people who are not backing her, that is something that they see as a bit of a concern.
Yes, and she was asked for clarification on that, and she kind of agreed with the comment when asked after she made that statement, do you think maternity pay is excessive? She said, I think it's gone too far the other way in terms of general business regulation. So there was a clarification there at the time. Listen, we're going to hear from two other contenders tomorrow, James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick. Tom Tugendhat we've already heard from there, but let's just briefly, Robert Jenrick, who we'll hear from tomorrow, has also faced questions about donations he's received. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so he faced questions about donations worth £70,000, which were made by a businessman called Philip Ullman. He has come forward today and said he was the source of those donations after they were filed under the name of the company, the Spot Fitness Limited. There have been questions for Robert Jenrick about the £75,000 donation made to his campaign in July, but now Philip Ullman is saying he doesn't want there to be any suggestion at all that he's hiding anything, said that he was the source of the donations, said frankly that that's because he's backing Robert Jenrick's campaign and he understands the importance of donations being transparent. So that's something that the Labour Party had started to say that there were questions to answer about this funding, but they've clearly tried to clear that up to some extent today.
Hannah, thank you so much. Hannah Miller there, our political correspondent, joining us from an extremely noisy Conservative Party conference that continues tomorrow. It is 25 minutes to five. Let's get the news headlines.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Israel's reported to have told the US it's planning to start a limited ground invasion of Lebanon as part of its operations against Hezbollah. CBS News is reporting a US official saying action could begin as soon as today. Hezbollah's deputy leader has vowed to respond. Some of the complaints made by Amanda Abington about her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannice have been upheld by the BBC. It's understood the corporation upheld allegations of verbal bullying and harassment, but it's cleared Mr. Pannice over claims of physical aggression. He's always denied any wrongdoing. Two of the four Conservative leadership candidates have addressed the party's conference in Birmingham. Tom Tugendhat has promised to rebuild the trust in the Tories, whilst Kemi Badenoch says she'd restore the winter fuel payment to pensioners, but not to millionaires. Robert Jenrick and James Cleverly will get their chance to address members tomorrow. And the UK's top civil servant has announced he's resigning. Simon Case has confirmed he'll be leaving his job as Cabinet Secretary at the end of the year for health reasons. That's your news. Your sport comes from Della Floyd.
Johnny, Manchester United are set to stick with manager Erik ten Hag for matches against Porto and Aston Villa this week, despite yesterday's dismal 3-0 home defeat to Tottenham. Ten Hag has endured a poor start to the season, which has left United 12th in the Premier League. However, the Dutchman, who signed a new contract with the club in the summer, says he and the owners are on the same page. BBC Sports chief football reporter Simon Stone says United can't afford for another disappointing season in the league.
Ten Hag has spoken a lot this season about the fact that they've won two trophies. They have. Only Sir Alex Ferguson has won trophies in three successive seasons. So that shows how hard it is. So it's not to be dismissed. However, Manchester United also finished eighth last year, which was the worst finish in the Premier League era. There is no way that Manchester United will countenance another eighth-placed finish.
Arsenal defender Jurrien Timber says he's in total agreement with Rodri following the Manchester City defender's strike warning and described the current fixture congestion as dangerous. Both Rodri and Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson have expressed concerns over playing too many games. Timber spent 9 months out last season with a knee injury. It's also revealed the increased number of matches is a big topic in the Arsenal dressing room.
To be honest, I totally agree with them. I think it's also like a big topic at the moment in dressing rooms, not only at City and Liverpool, also in our dressing room. But for me, what you said, I didn't play last season, so I'm just enjoying playing now. You won't hear me complain, but I totally understand what they're saying.
Meanwhile, Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta says Ricardo Calafiori will be assessed before tomorrow's Champions League tie against Paris Saint-Germain. The fullback suffered a knee problem in Saturday's win over Leicester. Ben White will also have a late fitness test. One game in the Premier League tonight as Bournemouth are at home to Southampton. Bournemouth's head coach Andoni Iraola won't be in the dugout though, as he's serving a one-game touchline ban after accumulating three yellow cards.
So I can go in the dressing room, I can give the speeches, the changes, whatever I decide, but it's true that I cannot shout, I have to stay quite calm, yes.
Leeds and Wales have suffered a major injury blow, with midfielder Ethan Ampadu set to be sidelined for the rest of the year with knee ligament damage. Leeds boss Daniel Farke says the midfielder won't need surgery, but is expecting it to be at least 10 weeks before Ampadu can return to training. And England's cricketers will now focus their attention on the forthcoming Test series away to Pakistan after their one-day series defeat to Australia. England lost by 49 runs under the DLS method in the fifth and deciding match in Bristol yesterday. The former England batter Nick Compton, however, says now is a good time to play Pakistan.
There is a time to take on Pakistan in Pakistan and win that series. I think it's now. I think Pakistan are struggling, and I think England's test team will be too strong for them. But it is foreign conditions, and a lot of the young players in that test team, as good as they are, wouldn't have played cricket in Pakistan. So it'll be a new opportunity for them.
England play their first test against Pakistan in Multan on Monday the 8th of October. That's to worry about next month, though. That's the latest from BBC Sports.
A look at your travel. The M6 in the West Midlands. It's a broken down lorry, but it's taking up two lanes on the southbound side. Junction 10 at Walsall. The queue stretched back to 10A at the M54. The A1M, the repairs, the bridge repairs, but there are emergency ones. They're supposed to be short term. Northbound, Junction 60 at Bradbury. One of the lanes is closed. It's causing slow traffic on the A1M. Then you've got the M62 in West Yorkshire looking heavy westbound at Chain Bar 26. A breakdown in one of the lanes there. Heavy rain is affecting the northwest and most of Yorkshire in particular at the moment, so you'll find driving conditions really poor and very difficult. The M1 and 14 at Milton Keynes. Heading south, another breakdown there with one lane closed. Get reports of a breakdown on the M61 south at Junction 7 at Adlington. The M60 busier than usual, 7 to 12. That's from Stretford towards the Eccles Interchange. The M6 really heavy at 21A at the Croft Interchange, and that's where it joins the M62. The M25 anti-clockwise queues at Staines at Junction 13. Debris partly blocking the road. And along the bottom, it's at Junction 6 at Godstone. There was an accident. It's been moved off the road, but it happened in the roadworks. So the queues are back to 7 at the M23, and it's still busy across the top as well, where the roadworks are at Enfield at Junction 25. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
Orna, thank you very much indeed. Delith, Orna, before you go, do you know what one of these is?
Yes, because you told us.
Did I? Oh,
damn
you
did. It. But I wouldn't have known.
Delith, what is it?
It's some sort of code science technology.
Yes.
There
some
you go.
Code science.
Got it.
What she said.
It's a it's a thingy me jiggy. It's a micro bit, and you have a primary school age child.
I do.
Coming to a playground near you soon.
Scary.
But brilliant, because it's about, and look what Johnny's wearing, something that lights up. Look at that.
That's very Back to the Future.
I mean, that is cool, yes, Johnny, to yeah. be fair.
Really cool. I can't even plug mine in. I can't plug it in. But basically, it's all about coding and introducing coding to primary school age kids. So they understand the basics of it, they're not intimidated by it, and it kind of comes into their day-to-day world, is that not correct?
Yeah, so
Johnny?
They're just kind of the habitual use of coding.
Yeah.
Means that they all know how to do it, because it is, whether we like it or not, it's the future.
And it's the best time to learn when you're young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's too late for all of us here.
Yes.
I think we've already proved
it.
That
we're past it.
In the last exchange. if you have children, we're going to get onto that next, actually. It's a really fascinating research project that the BBC is involved in. It's rolling out at schools across the country, so we're going to talk about that next. Mike Peters, lead singer from The Alarm, and his wife are going to be joining us in the studio. An incredible trial at the Christie here in Manchester. He kind of got the double blow. He'd lived with a sort of lymphoma for years, and then all of a sudden, back in April, had to cancel a US tour because he found a lump in his neck, and it was really bad news what it had progressed into. This trial at the Christie has essentially put him into remission. It's the first time it's ever happened. So we're delighted to say they're going to be joining us in the studio to talk about that.
And speaking of technological research as well.
Yep.
So there's some research out today that shows the scale of the shattered screen epidemic blighting Britain today.
Okay.
Apparently 1 in 10 people have a broken phone screen.
Yeah, I've got a broken phone back.
You included.
Yeah.
Mostly it's people dropping it on a hard surface. 1 in 33 people drop it into a lavatory. 1 in 50 fell from a window. I presume it's the phone, not the person. And 100 were attacked by a seagull, which is a very specific way of breaking a phone.
Just, have you been to Cornwall?
Yeah.
Just don't go outside.
Ilfracombe have been attacked twice by a seagull. Yeah. And I think it was the same one 2 years apart as well. Yeah. Anyway, the thing I was talking about is that we all have stuff that is broken and should be binned.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We insist on using it anyway. So I was wondering if we could just get people to give us their list of things that they have that is broken that they insist on using no matter what.
Yeah, so you live with it.
Yeah.
It's broken, but you live with it.
Gaffer tape together.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Toaster. There's toaster. One, I've got one in my kitchen right now.
I'll tell you about my toaster in a minute.
There you go.
Tease, isn't it?
Oh, isn't it? Keep us listening. 850-58. What is broken, but you still live with it? You can't live without it. 850-58.
The Football Daily Podcast on BBC Sounds.
I'm Joel Hart and I'm here at Liverpool's training ground interviewing the great Alison Becker.
I have three kids. They like to be on the goal when they play with me.
Do you see talent?
Yeah, I can see a little bit, but I would love to have a striker in the family.
Alison is up from the back and he comes. Oh, would you believe it?
In this club, I think we have this prophetic sentence, you never walk alone. It's always a reminder for me. The people are on my side.
On the Football Daily Podcast, you can hear the full interview as we talk all things goalkeeping and what it takes to be the number one at one of the world's biggest clubs.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
So we've just touched on this then, the issue of coding. Can any of us really confidently say we know how to do it? It's something that's been increasingly taught in our primary schools, and the BBC has been part of this through the Microbit Playground Survey. Kids in Key Stage 2 primary school classes across the UK have been given tiny computer devices, such as the one I've got on my wrist, known as Microbits, which they then have to code themselves to collect data about how active they are in school. And it shows that kids over half their time at school are stationary. Here's what some of the children who took part thought of the results.
I liked the playground survey. I was quite surprised when it said that I was sitting around most of the time. I was shocked because I wasn't sitting around, I was walking.
I think that it was a bit confusing that how much we were sitting and chatting because I didn't think that I sat and chat that much.
Well, here to tell us a bit more on the survey is Mary Gregory, a director at the Office for National Statistics. Afternoon to you, Mary. Give us an idiot's guide as to how this data was collected and the role of the Microbit, if you will.
Of course. So as you've mentioned, the Microbits are a pocket-sized computer. So just to put in perspective, that's smaller than a credit card. They have various sensors on them. So there's a temperature sensor, an accelerometer, and buttons that can be pressed to count things. And for the activity tracking, they were strapped to children's wrists so that they could see whether children were moving or not using the accelerometer.
Right. And how does the coding come into it? Again, an idiot's guide as to coding and what these children were actually doing.
Yeah, so you can link the Microbit up to a computer and you can use different approaches to coding. And so the children themselves could put in the coding to work out what they want to track on their Microbit. They download that onto the Microbit and then when they're moving around, it will track what they've programmed it to track.
Fantastic. I mean, we heard from a couple of the children there who were quite surprised at how much they sat around or were stationary. What are the headlines from this survey?
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, the main headline, which, as you heard from the children, is that on average, pupils spent 54% of their time inactive.
Wow.
So that was measuring pupils during lunch times and break times. So some of that, maybe they were eating their lunch. Maybe some of them are reading a book or doing some art activities. But I think the thing that perhaps surprises people, but then when you think about it, makes a bit more sense, is even if you're doing something like playing football or playing catch, you might feel active, but for some of that time, you're not actually moving around whilst you're doing it. So that would count as some active time, but also some standing time.
Right, okay. And I guess it's really important reminder to both the kids and parents, actually, just how actually being active should be a habitual thing that we try and tie into our day, not just relying on PE and game sessions.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's really exciting about a project like this. Children are learning to code. They're getting used to using data, which we all know is going to be increasingly important in the future. But it's also making them think about what they're doing and how they can change their behaviours or make decisions as a result of what they're learning kind of live from their Microbits.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much for being with us, Mary. If that survey shows that children aren't as active as we might think, so what does that mean for us as parents? Dr. Matt Slavin is here, a clinical psychologist, to tell us more. Hi, Matt, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
So what is the actual physiological and psychological benefits of being active? So, it sounds a silly question, but I think it's always important to remind ourselves, particularly for children.
Well, yeah, I think one of the misconceptions is that break time is that kind of absence of learning, but it's an absolutely vital part of a child's ability to learn. So when we know kids are being active, and particularly outdoor play, if they can get a bit of nature in there too, what's going on is kids are reducing their levels of stress in their body. They're actually improving their ability to attend by resetting their attentional part of the brain, because that part of the brain can get tired. It boosts their mood, so it emotionally regulates them. And it just puts them in the right place to have the right calm alert state to like pay attention when they come back into class.
Worth reminding ourselves, according to the chief medical officer, kids should be physically active for 60 minutes a day, so an hour a day, 30 of which should be within the school day. And I wonder if you think, and perhaps schools are doing this, of changing that mindset that actually it should be down to PE and organised lessons, and encouraging it in break times isn't necessarily a break, but an opportunity for kids to be physically active.
Yeah, I think that reframing is really important, like this study, just to remember that actually what they're doing there are key parts of the learning curriculum. And actually what you said about having some unstructured time is really important, because play for kids, play is the language of learning. And when kids are able to move and learn at the same time, what they're doing in unstructured environments is they're actually shown to improve their problem solving abilities, their greater creativity, and to get themselves in a really good place to learn.
Yeah.
So this is part of the whole what we want for our kids, right? Letting them be at their best.
Absolutely. And finally, Matt, how do you do that, encouraging that amongst children, particularly those that would say, I don't like sport or I don't like PE? I mean, again, it's about reframing, isn't it? But how do we encourage the children to be habitually physically active?
Well, I think it's about finding that curiosity and that motivation that with the kids. So I think doing things with kids is really important. So parents, you know, find time to really connect and have fun with them. If you're curious and interested, parents and teachers, if they are too, kids will get along with it too. But every kid's different. So yeah, you've got to find with kids, what are they interested in? What drives them? What motivates them?
Great advice. Matt, thank you ever so much for being with us. Dr. Matt Slavin there, clinical psychologist. And before that was Mary Gregory, a director at the Office for National Statistics. 10 to 5 now.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yes, it is 10 minutes to 5 o'clock. I think you've already said that, Johnny, but I'll say it again.
It's worth repeating.
Just so we're all clear about the time. Before 7, as the country's last coal power station at Ratcliffe-on-Soar finishes operations today, I've been speaking to the writer and creator of BBC One drama Sherwood and Nottinghamshire local James Graham, the brilliant James Graham, about his love for the landmark cooling towers there and his campaign to keep them.
This is really nerdy, sorry, but like the thickness of the wall compared to the amount of space that they surround is the equivalent of the shell of an egg compared to the egg itself. They shouldn't really be standing up, but they do miraculously. And a lot of locals call them these elephant feet because they look like they've got a thick base and they curve up and then back out again. I think they're so gorgeous, and I don't see why either a museum or even, if this was in Manchester, there'd be some like trendy sushi restaurant in the middle of it or something.
Oh, yeah.
That you just get to like enjoy. Or if it was in Germany, it'd be like a nightclub or a rave warehouse. And because it's Nottingham, we're just going to knock them down without thinking about it, and I can't bear it.
He's a great guy. It's such a fascinating interview. We'll play you that in the next hour, actually just after 6 o'clock, so you can hear that interview. It is now 9 minutes to 5. The brilliant The Alarm Band. We're going to speak shortly to Mike Peters, lead singer. He's been taking part in a clinical trial after he discovered a lump in his neck, which was diagnosed as a thing called Richter syndrome. That is an aggressive, fast-growing lymphoma. He'd already been living with CLL, a form of leukemia, for almost 30 years. And with this new treatment, he's now in remission. Before the programme, I caught up with Professor Adrian Blore, who's a consultant haematologist at the Christie, who is leading this particular trial.
Mike's had chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, for many years, which is a common blood cancer. It's often very slow growing, and people can live with it for a long time. And in a few percent of people, what can happen is that it speeds up. It transforms into something where it turns into a fast-growing type of blood cancer, and that's what Richter transformation, or Richter syndrome, is. And that's what he's been treated for the last few months.
And when you get that kind of diagnosis, what is the normal prognosis for that?
It's not good. With standard treatment, the prognosis with Richter syndrome is that most patients only have a life expectancy of a few months.
Right. So that is the news nobody wants to hear, especially someone who's been living with, as you say, CLL for all of those years.
Yeah.
What was the treatment then? What did you try that hasn't really been tried before?
So standard treatment with chemotherapy, we know, doesn't work as well as we would want it to. So Mike was enrolled into a trial. That's why he came to the Christie, which is looking at a combination of standard chemotherapy with a drug called acalabrutinib, which is a targeted treatment. The aim of that to try and more specifically target the cancer cells and looking at whether or not the combination of that with chemotherapy works better than the chemotherapy alone. So Mike was in the trial. And he received the new drug with chemotherapy and has had a really fabulous response.
That is Professor Adrian Blaw, and I'm delighted to say Mike Peters and his wife Jules join us in the Five Live Drive studio now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's so fantastic to see you, especially you, Mike.
It's a great day today.
Isn't it a great day? I mean, first of all, your thoughts on the professor there.
Oh, he's an amazing gentleman. I mean, he's a rock star hematologist. He looks cool. He's got better hair than the alarm ever had.
he has got a massive quiff.
He has, and he keeps people alive. People like me are very grateful for his intervention.
So even somebody like you, who's been living with this form of blood cancer for years, best part of 30 years, tell us what happened back in April.
Yeah, well, I was on the eve of a big American tour. We were about 5 days out from playing 50 dates across America. And I woke up one morning with a massive lump in my left side of my neck. It was like a fistful. And luckily, because I was going to America, I was seeing a hematologist in North Wales at the Cancer Treatment Centre in Bottlewithin, as a precaution before going to America. And as it happened, when I walked into that consultation, my blood count was absolutely plumb normal, so that was giving no indication. And he said, "Is there anything else we need to look at?" And I showed him the lump on my neck, and he could see his face turn ashen. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was having an emergency biopsy, and then it was confirmed I'd transformed into this form of disease called Richter syndrome, which I didn't know anything about. I'd never really heard of it before.
Yeah, and Jules, the prognosis wasn't good, was it?
The prognosis was poor. Two words, poor prognosis. So I've as Mike's wife, I've been with Mike through all his cancer battles. I was 28 when he was first diagnosed with CLL. I'm a breast cancer survivor myself, so I'm very, very used to the cancer world, but it absolutely threw me. I was on my knees. I really had to pull myself together just to, be able to get on with life and show Mike support. But I've been very open about it on the social media. I found it very, very difficult. However, now I do feel 5 months down the line, I feel a lot more hopeful. And in fairness to the Christie, they did say in the beginning, we have some optimistic options, but we have to throw the kitchen sink at you, which didn't fill me with a lot of hope.
No, duck.
Yeah.
But you didn't duck because they gave you this trial. Tell us what they did.
Yeah, well, at first, when I looked online, if I'd gone to America, I might have only lived for 2 months. It was that fast moving. But when I got to the Christie and spoke with a consultant, with Professor Blaw, he did say, as Jules said, we're going to throw the kitchen sink at you, but I wasn't quite expecting the fridge and the freezer and the oven to come following on. So they hit me with, they gave me the option of going on the Stella clinical trial. And I thought, what have I got to lose? I've got nothing to lose. I've got to trust Professor Blaw, trust the outcome, which I did, and dived into it headlong. And then I threw a curveball and said, am I okay to still play a few gigs while I'm having the chemotherapy? And he thought, if you're crazy enough to do it, then that's fine by me.
Yeah, and you did?
I did, yeah. We created a little bubble within our little small crew. We learnt a lot of things in the COVID-19 pandemic that kept me safe from infections while I got to stage and back out into the vehicles to leave the venue. So I was very lucky. And, survived all the chemotherapy sessions. They were quite hard, very aggressive. That was in Department 26, and the nurses were absolutely brilliant. And it's being in the Christie, it's like being in an academic medical environment, and all the nursing staff have laptops when they're at your bedside or they're administering chemotherapy. So it's very on the cutting edge where all the technology is. But on the other side, there's the old school technology where to read your pulse, they actually take hold of your wrist and read it in the old school way, which I've never had that in 30 years of being treated. It was always electronic measurements of your temperature or your pulse. Now in the Christie, they go back to the old school.
But I
think just that old school way of doing things, it allows you to bond a little bit with the nurse. You can have a little chat while they're trying to count your blood count, your pulse rate.
It's such a fantastic
It's a beautiful experience
really
in lots of ways.
So just to put the specifics on this, they combine standard chemotherapy with,
acalabrutinib. I had trouble with it.
Acalabrutinib. And this was the trial that they now say, because you've been so successful, you say the lump in your neck went down as fast as it came up.
That's right. It went by the second chemotherapy, I couldn't feel anything in my neck at all. And then I had a PET scan after the fourth chemotherapy, and going into the fifth chemotherapy, Professor Bloor said, look, you've done really well. We can almost stop the sixth one. We don't want to damage your heart anymore, put more toxics into your body, because we want to protect you for the stem cell transplant, which is the next part of my journey to recovery.
Well, listen, we wish you all the best with that. And Jules, how are you feeling? I mean, you've been through a lot yourself, for goodness sake.
I must have been very bad in a previous life.
Well,
no, you know what? I absolute devastation, but I've got two kids, I've got parents, and I pull myself together, and I just feel really grateful. I have to give a big shout out to the NHS, especially the Christie. Mike and I are actually really lucky, and in a very bizarre way, the last 5 months have kind of been the best months of our lives as well.
Wow, what a thing to say. Yeah. So much love for you on the text. Phil in Shropshire says, love the alarm since the 80s. Going to see Mike in Wolverhampton next year. All being well, he's a legend.
I'll survive for that, don't you?
Keep in touch. It's been amazing meeting both of you.
Thanks,
what
guys.
A message of hope. You
Thank
take
you very
care,
much indeed.
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Good afternoon, it's Claire McDonald and Johnny A. Anson on Drive. 5 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Here are your headlines. Reports from the US suggest Israel is planning to start a limited ground invasion of Lebanon. CBS News is reporting a US official as saying the next stage of action against Hezbollah could begin as soon as later today. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bechega has told Drive Israel is showing no sign of backing down.
I don't think there's any surprise here. All indications coming from Israel were towards, you know, the possibility of a ground operation in southern Lebanon. The Israelis have been saying that they want to allow the return of those 60,000 residents who have been displaced from communities in northern Israel. And military officials have been saying that the intention here is to create a so-called buffer zone in the south.
Hezbollah says it's ready to fight against any invasion. Amanda Abington says she feels vindicated by the findings of a BBC review into complaints she made about her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannice. The corporation upheld some of the actor's claims, but also cleared Mr. Pannice of the most serious allegations. The BBC's chief content officer, Charlotte Moore, has given her response to the findings.
We didn't feel that the behaviours met the standard that we would expect, and that's why some of the complaints have been upheld. If you're asking me, was it physical aggression? I think I can categorically say no. But I do want to apologise on behalf of the BBC to Amanda, and I also want to thank her for having the courage to come forward.
The four candidates wanting to replace Rishi Sunak as Conservative leader have been told they need to acknowledge how bad things are by his predecessor, Liz Truss. The former Prime Minister has spoken at the party conference in Birmingham. Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch have addressed members today before Robert Jenrick and James Cleverly get their chance to do so tomorrow. The UK's top civil servant has announced he's resigning from the job for health reasons. Simon Case first became Cabinet Secretary in 2020, September of that year. And the remaining blast furnace at Britain's largest steelworks is about to shut down. The Tata plant in Port Talbot is moving to greener technology at the expense of more than 2,500 jobs. Stuart Phillip has worked at the plant for 27 years.